So we're still in this season of Eastertide, these first 40 days after Easter. And I still want us to kind of focus in here, because I think with the disciples, we still have things to glean. And so I'm just looking at today's message. You're calling it How God's Kingdom Works. So my paragraph is the functioning of God's kingdom, devoid of competition, jealousies, and grandstanding, stood in stark contrast with the functioning of the disciples' world. Jesus' teachings and demonstrations of the kingdom, while definitely awe-inspiring, had to have been to some degree inconceivable to the entrenched thinking of his group of 12 guys. So many of the details seemed an impossible stretch, too peculiar, upside down even. Maybe Jesus meant for them to understand that he was simply exaggerating to make a point and not anticipating that they would follow these instructions legalistically. Maybe there was a hidden code they were yet to decipher. Or maybe he was openly revealing an entirely other reality, a portal into a divine community where pure love and joy and peace were constants, where happy laughter was the norm, where sin and its pollutions, including death, were banned for all eternity. And as I think of it, even today in 2021, our 21st century world, I think as Jesus describes the kingdom, as we keep looking at it, it's hard for us to picture how that system could work here. And yet we believe that when Jesus came, God's kingdom broke into our reality. So there is a presence of God's kingdom among us. And so we, you know, again, our theology tells us that there's the now and the not yet. So there's a part of the kingdom that's broken in, and yet there's a future aspect, a fuller aspect to come. But it's hard to think of the way Jesus describes the kingdom that it would actually function in our day. And the difficulty for the disciples and for us is that we live in the kingdom. And so our manner of operating and living today is according to the kingdom which we are now part of. You know, and Jesus said, you know, we're not of the world any more than he is of the world. So we are citizens of God's kingdom, where the functioning has no competition, no jealousies, and grandstanding. And so it's a little unusual to think about how that could possibly work. And so, again, I'm imagining that the disciples had a hard time understanding all of Jesus' teachings. And so I can easily picture, and this is part I'm just imagining at this point, I can easily picture Jesus having to go back and review some of the things he had told them before he went to the cross. And so in these 40 days, as Jesus is, each time he shows up to these guys, he's speaking of the kingdom. And so I want us to look in Matthew chapter 18 this morning. And here's something that shows that at least when he first described the kingdom, they just didn't really get it. So in Matthew chapter 18, the first verse, at that time, the disciples came to ask Jesus, who is considered to be the greatest in heaven's kingdom realm? Well, what Jesus has been trying to explain to them, obviously they didn't get it, because it isn't a matter of who's the greatest. And so, you know, I think Jesus goes back to that picture and says, well, it's really not quite like that, you know, and I can see him needing a second go at this. And so if we turn over to Matthew chapter 20, there are verses there that help us to see Jesus' teaching. And so Matthew 20, beginning in verse 20, and this is Passion Translation, a bit different wording, but I think it's helpful. The wife of Zebedee approached Jesus with her sons, Jacob and John, or James and John, I guess. She knelt before him. She knelt before him and asked him for a favor. He said to her, "What is it that you want?" She answered, "Make the decree that these my sons will rule with you in your kingdom, one sitting on your right hand, one on your left." Jesus replied, "You don't know what you're asking." Then, looking into the eyes of Jacob and John, Jesus said, "Are you prepared to drink from the cup of suffering that I am about to drink? And are you able to endure the baptism into death that I am about to endure?" They answered him, "Yes, we are able." Jesus said, "You will indeed drink the cup of my suffering and be immersed into my death," Jesus told them. "But to be the ones who sit at the place of highest honor is not mine to decide. My Father is the one who chooses them and prepares them." The other 10 disciples were listening to all of this, and a jealous anger arose among them against the two brothers. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, called them to his side and said, "Kings and those with great authority in this world rule oppressively over their subjects like tyrants. But this is not your calling. You will lead by a completely different model. The greatest one among you will live as the one who is called to serve others, because the greatest honor and authority is reserved for the one with the heart of a servant. For even the Son of Man did not come expecting to be served by everyone, but to serve everyone, and to give his life in exchange for the salvation of many." So as we think of this passage that Jesus talked to the disciples about before he went to the cross, I'm sure they were just like, well, Jesus, maybe some of them were thinking, you know what, that might work in your kingdom, but it'll never work here on earth. That is not the way things work here. And so putting ourselves in the last place, like you're talking about, is just really not going to work. And so that's why I think Jesus had to come back and review with the disciples after the resurrection some details about this is how the kingdom works. You know, and somewhere this week, we've all read the story or heard this. It's kind of a urban legend at this point, but at some point there was an ocean liner that saw another ship in its path and sent the message, "You're on a collision course, change course." And the message from the other ship came back and said, "You change course, we're on the right course." And then the captain stood back and said, "I am an ocean liner," or whatever it is. "And so, you know, you had better change course because, you know, there's going to be a collision." And again, the message came back, and a third message from the captain. And finally, the last message from the other said, "This is the lighthouse. We advise that you change course." You know, so we've all heard these stories. And I think when Jesus talks about the kingdom, he says, you know what? This is the kingdom. This is the way it's set up. And so the kingdom is not going to change its manner of functioning to fit what you think works. It's been established for all eternity. And so if there's a change, the change is going to be on your side, not the kingdom. And so anyway, as we was thinking of that story, I thought, well, we've probably all heard some version of that. And, you know, I don't even know if there's even a true story attached to it somewhere, but it's morphed into a pretty cool story, at least. So in the first point here, it's the non-existence of power plays. And, you know, and again, that's difficult for us to imagine, because the way things work in our society is, you know, the power play, the one who exerts the most energy and, you know, does the end run around opponents or whatever to show that they're the one with the power. They're the ones who get to decide how things work. And Jesus, well, in God's kingdom, in my kingdom, in your kingdom now, where you live, and move and have your being. That doesn't exist. We don't operate that way. And I don't want you guys operating like the tyrants of the world, fighting your way to the top. And so he used the example of the mother of James and John coming. I know one other gospel doesn't mention the mother coming, but the point is still the same. And one of the gospel writers just says James and John are the ones that came to Jesus asking to sit at his right and his left. And, you know, and so they were kind of gently rebuked, shall we say, and said, that is not for me to do it. But beyond that, not only is it mine to give you that position, it's my Father, but that's not how the kingdom functions. And so you really have to rethink that. And I think even in our day in the 21st century, as we go about living in this world, we've got to also remind ourselves that how the world gets ahead is not how we're to get ahead. And, you know, and so we kind of need to back up just a little bit. But then coming back to this, the Matthew 18 passage, after the disciples asked, these two disciples came and asked that, Jesus continues in verses 2-6 to illustrate the point. Jesus called a little one to his side and said to them, learn this well. Unless you dramatically change your way of thinking and become teachable and learn about heaven's kingdom realm with the wide-eyed wonder of a child, you will never be able to enter in. Whoever continually humbles himself to become like this gentle child is the greatest one in heaven's kingdom realm. And if you tenderly care for this little one on my behalf, you are tenderly caring for me. But if anyone abuses one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for him to have a heavy boulder tied around his neck and be hurled into the deepest sea than to face the punishment he deserves. What astonishing things Jesus is saying. Here's Jesus who has maybe by this time raised the dead, calmed the sea, fed 4,000 one time, 5,000 another, once with two loaves and five fishes, and has healed blind man, healed the leper, done all these things. The guys have always watched this. And then, you know, he says, you need to dramatically change if you're going to understand, if you're going to really be at home in this kingdom realm, which is now operating and in which you belong. And, you know, I think the first time these disciples heard this, it was just like, can't really understand what Jesus is saying. How is that ever going to work? And so bringing a child and saying, I want you to picture becoming as innocent and as gentle and as non-offensive as this little child. And it's in that aspect and with that mindset that you will enter, that you will be at home in my kingdom. And so I like it when in the Passion Translation, Jesus says, learn this well. You know, it's going to be really important. And I think he's emphasizing it because it is a hard thing to understand. Our culture does not promote people who interact as gentle little children. You know, you want to be sly, you want to be maybe even ruthless. We seem to, you know, we promote MVPs, we promote stars, we have the superstars, we have programs where we give Oscars and Emmys and Obies and I don't know what all, ESPYs, and all these things to who are the best and who wins and who has the title and who stands up with the gold medal. We honor all of these things, all of these heroic things in our thinking. And Jesus is saying, but you know what, guys? That's really not how the kingdom really works. And so the gentleness, the humility, the taking the last place, that's really what functions well in my kingdom. And that's how you're called to operate. And so if we look at this other verse in Matthew 23, which I think is also pretty astonishing that Jesus would say this familiar verse, Matthew 23, verse 37, you know, Jesus says, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you are the city that murders your prophets. You are the city that stones the very messengers who were sent to deliver you. So many times I have longed to gather you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were too stubborn to let me." Here's Jesus talking as if he was as tender toward the disciples and those who would follow him, as tender as a mother hen would gather her chicks during a time of storm. And I don't know if you've ever been on a farm, but if there is a storm coming, you will see the hens running around with their wings outstretched and pulling their little ones underneath. And then she hunkers down and actually hides her own head underneath her wing, and she rides out the storm with her little ones there. It's pretty amazing to watch that. And so Jesus is expressing his own tender love and protection to the disciples in terms of a mother hen protecting her little innocent ones. And so I'm not really sure if the disciples could picture that aspect of Jesus, even though they'd benefited from it multiple times, and they had seen him in action. And Jesus was taking care, noticing people that other people would probably not have noticed at all. You remember that stirring story of the widow of Nain. As they're coming into the town, the funeral procession is coming out, and her only son has died, and he's being carried out of the city. You know, most people would have just, you know, given a wide berth to the funeral procession and kept on their way, but not Jesus. He stops, and he goes up to this grieving woman, and she was a widow, so obviously if this was her only son, basically her only means of support had died, and she was going to be the most bereft in that society in their day. And Jesus takes time to have compassion on this woman and raises her son to life again. You know, so the disciples have seen these things, and maybe they thought they were just one off. You know, it's just like, oh, Jesus had a moment. You know, but that's really not the way it ordinarily would work. Maybe they're just exceptional things. But apparently what Jesus is emphasizing, and I see him emphasizing that in these first 40 days after his resurrection, the second point here is the non-existence again of pride's one-upmanship. And so that's not the way they were to operate. Because, you know, little children don't even know one-upmanship. You know, they're just so innocent, you know. And if they ever do something like that, it's so innocent, it's almost charming. It almost makes you smile. It's like, wow, they didn't even know what they did, you know. But Jesus is just saying, here it is. This is the way you are to operate. And this is what receives the most honor in the kingdom. So this is the upside down stuff. And I can really picture Jesus having to go back and review that aspect of his kingdom with his disciples. So as we move on in Matthew 19, verses 13 through 15, there's there's this other these other few verses that I think are pretty powerful to talk to this the situation that Jesus is referring to as far as the how his kingdom operates. So in verses 13 through 15, again, about little children, verse 13 in Matthew 19, then they brought little children to Jesus so that he would lay his hands on them, bless them, and pray for them. But the disciples scolded those who brought the children, saying, "Don't bother him with this now." Jesus overheard them and said, "I want little children to come to me, so never interfere with them when they want to come. For heaven's kingdom realm is composed of beloved ones like these. Listen to this truth. No one will enter the kingdom realm of heaven unless he becomes like one of these." Then he laid his hands on each of them and went on his way. And so, you know, we've mentioned this before, but can't you just see these disciples going, Jesus has so many important things to do and so many other people to meet and so much message to get out. He doesn't have time to deal with these little kids. You know, the little kids, and maybe in Israel, little kids were basically, as when I was brought up back in the dark ages in Canada, you know, children were to be seen and not heard. You know, if adults were talking, you really didn't intervene. You didn't speak. The boldest thing that probably we ever did as kids, if adults were around, is we would go in and we would try to stand patiently, probably not very well, but, you know, and every once in a while, maybe never my father, but my mother, we would kind of tap her on the arm, maybe. Kind of, you know, like to see if we could get her attention. And she was really good at ignoring us sometimes when there was adult conversation happening. But, you know, you certainly never would barge into the room as if, you know, you had all the right of way and, you know, and making a noise or whatever. I mean, somehow we just knew that that was bad form and it would probably end badly for us. So, you know, we knew better. And so maybe that was the attitude that a lot of adults had, maybe the disciples had, thinking Jesus is way too important to waste time on these little kids. And Jesus overheard them. And I love this when he says, never interfere with little children when they want to come to me, because I want them to come to me. And then he says, God's realm, God's kingdom realm is made of beloved ones like these. What, you know, maybe it wasn't even such a gentle slap in the face to the disciples at that point, but Jesus is saying, guys, you know, how many times do I have to tell you? Children are very important, and you can't, when he says you can't enter the kingdom, I think it just means you will never be at home. You will never feel comfortable in God's kingdom with the mentality you now have. You will be comfortable if you become like these little ones who are unpretentious and humble and unassuming and just pure in hearts. And so Jesus goes back at it and he says, you know, one more time, this is not going to be the way you operate, guys. And so the third point, carrying on, is the non-existence of prestige and preening, which they were so used to, you know, and we have a lot of people who get ahead in our day with prestige and preening and, you know, strutting about, you know, and all of these things. And Jesus is just continually driving home the message that, yes, guys, I know that's what you've learned. I know that's what you've heard, but this is what I tell you. And you know, there are many places within the Gospels that Jesus says, this is what you've heard, but I tell you this. This is what you've heard, but I tell you this, and each time he was just showing them the opposite of what they knew. And so I think what's great in this is for those of us, many of us here this morning feel like, you know, we're really not that much and we don't really have much. So the whole strutting and preening and all those things, we really don't have much to start that up with. And so what Jesus is doing is helping us see that there is room for people like us. As a matter of fact, people like us maybe get priority in the kingdom because we are aware that we don't come with much. You know, many of us don't come with great pedigrees and all this, the royalties and all these things. And so as each time Jesus talks about how upside down the kingdom is, it maybe opens the doorway even wider for us and going, oh, well, maybe there's room for me then. Maybe I could really do this. Or maybe, you know, people who come, like I mentioned last week, the thief on the cross, you know, who asks Jesus to remember him when he comes into his kingdom and into paradise. And Jesus does remember him and says, yes, you will come. You know, so even those who come at the 11th hour after having wasted their lives and done all kinds of things, Jesus, when he sees the humility of attitude and sees that they are now, even now at the last moment, sad, sorry, regretful, he goes, okay, I'll make room in my kingdom for you, because it's that attitude that we honor in the way things operate in my kingdom. And then the fourth thing in Matthew 23, the first 12 verses. Jesus is speaking and he says, then Jesus addressed both the crowds and his disciples and said, the religious scholars and the Pharisees sit on Moses' throne as the authorized interpreters of the law. So listen and follow what they teach, but don't do what they do, for they tell you one thing and do another. They tie on your backs an oppressive burden of religious obligations and insist that you carry it, but will never lift a finger to help ease your load. Everything they do is done for show and to be noticed by others. They want to be seen as holy, so they wear oversized prayer boxes on their arms and foreheads with scriptures inside and wear extra long tassels on their outer garments. They crave the seats of highest honor at banquets and in their meeting places. And how they love to be admired by men with their titles of respect, aspiring to be recognized in public and have others call them reverend. Please don't ever call me reverend. But you are to be different from that. You are not to be called master, for you have only one master, and you are all brothers and sisters. And you are not to be addressed as father, for you have one father who is in heaven. Nor are you to be addressed as teacher, for you have one teacher, the anointed one. The greatest among you will be the one who always serves others from the heart. Remember this, if you have a lofty opinion of yourself and seek to be honored, you will be humbled. But if you have a modest opinion of yourself and choose to humble yourself, you will be honored. Now, I think what's hilarious here, if you remember in the first verse, Jesus addresses both the crowds and his disciples. Who would have been in the crowd looking for something to accuse Jesus of? The religious scholars, the very ones he's basically denouncing and calling them out for, you know, for their attitude of superiority and, you know, all the desiring the best places and wearing the things that would be most oppressive to the adoring public. And Jesus is saying, follow their law because they're teaching you what Moses said, but be careful not to do what they do because it's all for show. They couldn't care less about how you are. But you will lead with humility from the heart. And so even though it seemed difficult for the disciples, I just think Jesus coming back to this message was freeing, because it's like, well, for one thing, we have nothing to boast about, really. We don't really have much of that, just like we probably think we don't. But Jesus is just reiterating, and I'm sure he did during those 40 days after the resurrection, again, all right, this is what you've seen. This is what looks like a power play. This is what pride looks like. This is what prestige and preening looks like. But none of those things fit the kingdom of God, the way things operate in this new kingdom which you are entering. And so the fourth thing is the non-existence of position and pomp. And so all of these titles that Jesus is saying, don't be called reverend, don't be called teacher, don't be called master. He's just saying, don't be looking for that kind of human approval, because I am all of those things to you. I am enough for you. I am all you need. You know, and so we, you know, our worship songs often said, you know, you're all I have, but you're all I need. And so as we look at this, Jesus is saying, I am your sufficiency. So don't be looking for all of the props and all of these things from the world around you, because I give these to you. You are accepted in the beloved. You've been adopted. And if you remain in my love and do the things that I've asked you to do and commanded you to love one another and to come together as one, the world then will know that you lead by your heart, you lead by love, you lead by this humble one down position. And that will draw the world, because the world is sick of its own situation. You know, the world, if you're really honest with, you know, people are really honest with you, they hate this, you know, because everybody gets burned by the way the world operates with this pride and one-upmanship and all this. And so it's not good for anybody. And so I think Jesus is constantly coming back to this and using the illustration of little children and the gentleness. And that's why, if you've had a chance to read Chris's latest story about the stones by the Jordan, you know, the whole idea of being made soft, taking hearts of stone and being made into, as scripture says in the verses he pointed out, you know, made into like little children, just the little, the simple and the gentle and the humble. That was so powerful, especially as I was thinking of, you know, what Jesus was talking about as he described the kingdom. And yesterday I just cited this verse in the title to my note that I sent. But at the bottom of the page, I've got this Psalm 127 that Solomon wrote, again from the Passion. But it said, children are God's love gift. They are heaven's generous reward. Children born to a young couple will one day rise to protect and provide for their parents. Happy will be the couple who has many of them. A household full of children will not bring shame on your name, but victory when you face your enemies, for your offspring will have influence and honor to prevail on your behalf.